So the majority of societies are held together by three or four things. They're held together by religion, rituals. They're held together by kinship and families, as I've explained, and they're held together often by very strong political forces, an absolutist state or other. Yet modern societies aren't held together by that. They're not held together by kinship, as I said. Religion is often quite unimportant, and it's fragmented into little groups of co-believers. And supposedly they live in democracies, therefore there's no absolutist state. So what is going to hold them together? This is the biggest question for sociology. It's behind the work of many of the greatest sociologists like Ferdinand Tönnies or Emile Durkheim. And it is the big question for China. What's going to hold China together? The market can't do this alone. Money, of course, joins you, but it isn't enough. And as you move on into the adventure of not having a familistic society, which you've had for 2,000 years, as you try to work out a way of having increasing freedom and a less powerful political system from the center, and as you fragment your religious rituals and beliefs so that you have many different traditions together, what is going to hold you together? Durkheim never solved this problem. He thought that the division of labor in society, people doing different jobs, would hold them together. But that doesn't give you any moral unity at all. His solution was unsatisfactory. So what holds together a modern society like England? What I think holds it together, I think is the solution which China may opt for, is the creation of many artificial groupings, similar to a games team or an orchestra or a firm or a business. The English, as Tocqueville observed, and even more so their offshoot, the Americans, had opted for this system of creating meaningful sub-communities, not based on where you lived, on religions, or on kinship, but on choosing to belong together for some purpose. Long ago, Tocqueville says, that being so, the need to club together is more generally felt because the urge to get things is more general and stronger. In order to get anything done in the modern world, it's not enough to be an individual. You need other people. I couldn't have given these lectures without the help of Professor Liu and Professor Liu Dong and Wang Hui and all of you. I need you all. And you need me to lecture to you. So we need to be sharing these things. And this associationism is the heart of, I think, of English success and society. And it's very different from almost anywhere else in the world, though it's spread. Another French writer said, the French think in terms of family and the nation. The English tend to think in terms of the individual and society. And society is composed of many groupings. What we call civil society, that's the technical term in political science for this phenomenon. The English love to form into clubs and associations. Fei Xiaotong, in his book on From the Soil, his most famous single account of how the difference between the East and the West, says the great difference is that China is based on what he calls rippling out from an individual of relationships. West is based on groups. You belong to this and that firm group. I think he, because he didn't really have a deep and long experience of the West, he based his model on his travels to America and England. He'd spent time in other European countries, and if he looked at the history, he would have seen that what he took to be the West was actually England and America recently. But all the same, he was grasping hold of the central fact, which is the great difference between China as he knew it and the West, that he experienced was the difference between familistic relational society and associational group society. The English love to form into clubs and associations. If you think of the world around you, in many parts of the world, it's filled with clubs which were, many of them, and types of organization invented in England. The Cubs, the Brownies, the Scouts, the Girl Guides, the Salvation Army, Oxfam, the Samaritans, Amnesty International, the Rotarians, many, many others. And then there's a slightly other ways, the universities I mentioned, Oxford and Cambridge, are clubs of a kind. The political clubs, the great political clubs of London, the Royal Society, the British Academy, in academic life, the trades unions, the BBC, and so on and so on, football clubs. All are associational entities. If you just think of one sub-aspect to give you an example, if you think of travel and nature, to enjoy travel and nature, it's best to organize yourself into little clubs and associations. A single person won't get the best out of this. And one observer, Claudio Benes, notes how the English have invented a numerous and vigorous progeny, that's children, of mountaineering clubs, geographic societies, yachting associations, hang gliding federations, botanical gardens, zoological societies, societies royal for the prevention of cruelty to animals, wilderness societies, gardening subcommittees, conservation societies, green parties, angling clubs, landscape painting societies, animal liberation zealots, bird watching clubs, and so on. That's just one aspect of life, nature. Clubs can be very small. You can have a club in England which is just friends, really. You just maybe meet every Sunday and have a drink together or a meal together. That's one kind of club. Like-minded people. Sometimes they can be bigger and often directed towards. A feature of a club is that it has a particular thing it does. There are several features I should mention. One is that to join it is a conscious act. You dedicate yourself to joining this club. And often you can't just join it, you have to be invited into it because you're going to affect the life of other people. It's like not Oxford or Cambridge College, you have to be elected into it. And people can say, no, I know that person, I don't want him. You can, what's known as blackball, keep them out. So you have to be elected into them, or join them, even when they're very informal. And they always have a goal. It's a specific goal. That's the feature of clubs. They're different from families. Families, the traditional kind I was mentioning, are all-purpose institutions. You pray together, you eat together, you work together, and so on and so on. A club is a single function. It's a club to play cricket, tennis, to engage in politics, go mountaineering, go skiing. It has a specific goal, and that's why you can join lots of them if you want to. Most English people, and particularly at university, if you look at the list of clubs at Cambridge University, for example, there are about 100 or 150 different clubs you can join for almost any kind of activity. And many people are members of a number of them. When I was at school, even when I was 8 or 9, the moment I arrived at my boarding school, people would say, well, do you want to join the choir? Do you want to join the cricket club? Do you want to join the stamp collecting club? Do you want to do this? Do that? And you joined all these different things. I mean, the modern manifestation, to a certain extent, is Facebook. But Facebook, of course, is different, because anyone can join Facebook, more or less. And it doesn't form, actually, a face-to-face group of people. One of the most distinctive kinds of club, which has interested me, and another English invention, is the club to drink together and eat together. I sometimes wonder why the Chinese don't have pubs and inns of this, or any other culture. One reason why the Chinese and the Japanese, although they have sake, bars and so on. To a certain extent in China, one of the reasons is that you need the right drink. If you have a very alcoholic drink, as in sushi bars in Japan, you all get drunk, and then you have a sort of friendship, and you just sort of sit there drinking. But it's different from an English pub where you're chatting and talking. The great thing about beer, A, that the English were so rich that they could drink vast quantities, and everyone could afford more or less beer for much of English history. So you have a sociable drink. But it's also quite mild. You can drink quite a lot of beer if you drink it slowly without getting drunk. Just pleasant, a pleasant feeling. So you need a lot of leisure, which the English, as I mentioned, had. You need a drink, and you have enough wealth to go. And then you have this quintessentially English phenomenon. The higher level you have the inn. The inn is a place, big coaching inns, where people were travelling, and England was filled with travellers. The roads were just filled with people going to Maitley. They'd stop at Lincoln or Stamford or London or wherever, and they would put up the night in the inn. If any of you have read Charles Dickens, his novels are filled with people going into inns. And these were places you could stay and eat, and you could meet people, and you could hire a room and do things in these inns. They were found in all middling-sized towns in England, more or less, several of them. And it was an interesting fact that the English, and this is another sign of their family system, if you travelled around in England, you wouldn't go and stay with your kin, usually in another place. You would go and stay in the local inn. Even now, if I'm travelling around England, I tend, even if I know I have some cousin or second cousin or even a brother or sister in the place, I'm a bit reluctant to go and impose on them. I would rather go and stay nowadays, not so much in the inn as bed and breakfast. The English have tended to go and stay with strangers in inns. But perhaps even more odd and important was a slightly lower institution called the pub. Now, pub stands for public house. And a public house, it's a difficult thing to explain, really. Have any of you been into an English pub? No? Great experience. If you want to get the quintessence of England, obviously, certainly in the past, you go to an English pub, drink a certain amount, and then you go and watch a game of cricket, and then you have the English experience. The English pub is half private. It's someone's house, which has, set off a room into which people can come and sit around and drink. And the wonderful thing about it is that strangers come into it. Obviously, in a small village, it may be the same people, so you get a core. There's a very good description of English drinking and pub habits in a book written by a former student of mine. I lectured to her, called Kate Fox, called Watching the English. It's a good introduction. She's an anthropologist, and her father's a distinguished anthropologist. Watching the English, she spent a lot of time in pubs looking at pub etiquette, how you order a drink, and how you behave in pubs. And you can go into a pub, and strangers, you'll go up to the bar. You have to do all the rules are very, very carefully worked out, where you sit and so on. But English know what to do. You go and sit by the bar, and you turn to the person here, who's never met in your life, and you say, nice day. And they say, yeah, it's a nice day. Would you like a drink? They'll say, maybe. And then you are friends, in a superficial way. And then you can spend an hour talking to them about anything. See you again, and then you go off again. Very strange phenomenon. Whereas, many of the local inhabitants just go there every evening. Even today, to a certain extent, the television and so on, they continue in many parts of England, they're diminishing. So, but what was another feature which I hadn't really realised until I was working on these lectures is that they were very important politically, because you would find other people would come in, and then you'd start talking, and you'd talk to your neighbours, and so on, in an easy, friendly, face-to-face way. And you'd say, monstrous, this government. seeing the taxes they've been putting on this, or they're attacking Iraq, or whatever it is you complain about. And you'd find other people say, yes, I agree. It's the, if you like, it is the Facebook or Twitter of the age. It's a place where people can share ideas and criticize and comment on how things are. And people gain in self-confidence. They exchange news. News travels very fast. And you can criticize anyone. If the, you know, some rich person comes into the pub and starts, you know, saying this and that, you can say, no, I don't agree with you. So it's a very egalitarian atmosphere of semi-friendship between people who don't necessarily know each other. And you find nothing like it in any continental country. The pub, and the pubs have spread, but they're very distinctively English. And later, of course, you then got other drinks coming in, like Chinese tea, and you get tea houses and coffee shops. But there's something different about tea houses and coffee shops. In a tea house and a coffee shop, you go in with someone, and then you have a conversation with them. On the whole, you don't tend to go into a tea house in order to seek company. To begin with, the arrangement is different. In a pub, there's usually a bar, a long place where the person is serving. So you have someone behind, and they'll be serving. And so you sit along there, and you can talk to other people like that. In a tea house, you sit down at separate tables, usually, and so you don't meet new people. Drinking of that way, in a kind of open way, is the quintessence of English culture, and it continues even into academic culture. In my own experience, in my discipline of social anthropology, if you ask where the most important place in, say, Oxford University anthropology in the 20th century, where the great anthropologists existed, Evans, Pritchard, and others, it was the pub. The seminars were arranged so that they would end the moment the pubs were open. The pubs opened at 6 o'clock, so the Oxford seminar was at 4:30 to 6. The moment the bell struck 6, they'd say, "Oh, right, end of seminar," and they'd all rush off. And then for 2 or 3 hours, all the things they hadn't been able to say, they said in the pub. In Cambridge, we have the same tradition. After the students, after the seminars, their main seminars, that is the postgraduate students, will go for a drink with the speaker to a pub. So if this was in England, we'd have had this seminar at, or lectures at 5 o'clock, perhaps. And then afterwards, some of you would have come with me. But where would you have gone? No pub. So there we are, another thing to introduce. The importance of associations is what I want to stress. The quintessence of a successful modern society is trust. Trust between people. It's essential for business, it's essential for politics and democracy, it's essential for all our lives. And how do you generate trust in a world of strangers? Trust is all right within the family because you know each other, or in a traditional society where you don't move away from a village. You know people and you know their history. But we live in a world of strangers. You're constantly meeting people. And how do you know that you can trust them? So the building up of a trusting society where you know how to trust people and people are mostly trustworthy is very important. And it's something which has struck me about England for the last half thousand years, the last 500 years. To take one observation in the 19th century, this mutual confidence in and dependence on each other for what is right, fair and reasonable between man and man creates what it relies upon, nourishes the moral sense in all classes. Confidence, moral confidence between man and man is a peculiar characteristic of the spirit of society in England. It is the lay religion, it is the religion of the English, namely trust. Trust and the breaking of trust is the quintessence of English social ethics. You can see it in our legal system. Most people don't in England now know anything about the history of our English legal system. Basically, we had two legal systems running side by side. One was the common law, which dealt with crime and things like this, and the other was the equity law, equity courts. Equity means fairness. And so we had as much energy going into courts which dealt with fairness, trust, the breaking of trust, honour, and so on, as we had dealing with criminal cases. The famous, if you want to read a wonderful account of the last days of the rather run-down system of equity, then Charles Dickens's Bleak House is at the trail of the Court of Chancery, and the case in the Court of Chancery describes all this. So we have a whole legal system which is trying to maintain trust between people. And the system of trust was built up in England from a legal device called the trust. Some of you may have heard of trust and antitrust legislation and so on. By an accident, a total accident, in the 14th century, i.e. 700 years ago, lawyers in England invented a device for getting round the payment of tax to the crown from rich landowners. They basically, when a person had a son and they wanted to leave their property to their son, normally, if this was a rich family, when this person died, the king would come along and say, I take that property, it's mine, or I want a large amount of tax from it. So the English invented a device whereby, while this person was alive, they set up a trust. That meant they got 12 of their friends and they said, I will formally leave all my property to you. I will make a written document. All my land is yours, these 12 people. So when this person died, the king came along and said, I want some of this property. People would say, well, it belongs to these people. They're all still alive. Now, these held it in trust so that they would then pass it on like that. So it was a trick. This is the most important trick in history, more or less. It's a fiction, a trick. Because out of this, it started as a device for this. And then later, it grew and grew. It was such an important trick, because what it does is to get a group of people to cooperate together on the basis of trust and friendship, to make an organization which is not anything to do with the government. If you could develop such a device in China, it would have or it was widespread, I don't know if there is such a device, but if it was supported by the government. It's a non-governmental organization, but it's completely non-governmental, and it's supported by the government. So the basis of many things in England, for example, religious freedom, the first independent churches like the Baptists, the Quakers, the Methodists, were trusts. Even today, the Catholic Church in England is a trust, a separate trust. The Stock Exchange, the Bank of England, Lloyd's Insurance, all the big businesses were trusts. The universities, political clubs, the trade union movement, the games, the organization of games, the clubhouses, and so on. In social life, in economic life, in religious life, everywhere, these are organized like a Cambridge College or whatever, as a trust, a group of people who share assets. It never dies, it can go on as long as you like, it has a purpose. So what you have in the end in England, in almost all societies, you just basically have the center, state, and you have state and individuals. You may have or families, as I said, little families like this. And no intermediary institutions, nothing between the state and the family. That was the description I gave you of France, that, which has the state and the family. What happened was the growth in England over time of lots and lots of middling level institutions which lie between the individual and the state. And you belong to all of these. And that means that when the state tries to do anything, it has to deal with lots and lots of these institutions which can act as a balance. A recent case in England was when the state, our parliament, tried to introduce the idea that we sell off all our British forests to individuals. And all the middling level institutions like the National Trust, and the Society for the Preservation of Rural England, and so on and so on and so on, all objected and they withdrew it. And this happens again and again. There are many, many lobbying groups in a way like this, which can stand between the state and the individual and protect them. This is why in fascist societies, fascist means to bundle together. And in Germany and Italy, under fascism, what they did was to destroy all those middle level institutions. They bundled them together and said they all belong to the state. And in the French Revolution, the same thing happened. This is Rousseau's philosophy, that there should not be these middle level institutions. Yet if you don't have that, you cannot have freedom. Because the individual or the family is too weak to stand up against the state. So modern liberalism, liberal philosophy, depends on this accidental development, which was taken to America. And de Tocqueville, in his Democracy in America, said this is the most important part of American society, associationism. Now, it's not an easy thing to introduce if you don't have it, because if you have just one or two associations, then they are a great threat to the state, because everyone joins them. So what you basically want to do is to try and encourage lots and lots of them. They can be local government institutions, people ruling and running their own lives, because it has a tremendously beneficial effect, because people feel in control of themselves. They decide whether they want to do this hobby or they want to discuss this thing or whatever. And they don't feel constrained, they feel free. You take charge of your own life. De Tocqueville famously said that if he was a dictator in England, he wouldn't worry at all about getting rid of the House of Commons and Parliament and things like that. They can easily be dealt with. What he would be worried about were people gathering together in their village and discussing how to rebuild the church tower. Because that teaches you democracy. He said it teaches you how to be democratic at the low level and to be responsible for your own life and gives meaning to your life. And I think unless a society develops a lot of this kind of level of intermediary institutions, it is going to find it very difficult to hold things together. In a way, you can say it's a system of divide and rule. You have many, many divisions of this kind. But it's something which, with growing wealth, with fast communications technologies in the world today and so on, people are calling for this. This is what is obviously behind a lot of what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. And something which I think historically it's worth observing how an associational civil society world emerged on this funny little island. Thank you very much.